We have 58 degrees at 8:04. Good morning to you. I'm Jay Moran, and this is WBFO News. A Niagara County grand jury has handed down a 122-count indictment against a Lewiston man accused of kidnapping and torture. Ivor Fallon pleaded not guilty during his arraignment. The district attorney said the victims were strangled and hanged to the point of blacking out and having seizures. Funding dedicated for Buffalo's waterfront should be spent on parkland, not parking ramps. That according to Representative Brian Higgins. He says since parking structures are self-financing, the limited resources for the waterfront could be better spent improving public access.
The dense residential development that Erie Canal Harbor Development's consultant has recommended for the Outer Harbor, in the explanation, they say that they need that tax revenue to build parks. I'm simply looking at a new creative way to finance what is outlined in the parks component of their plan for the Outer Harbor.
Higgins says plans for Canal Side include over $19 million for parking structures. He says that's enough money to build several more pocket parks along Furman Boulevard. In a written response, ECHDC Chairman Robert Joya said the public preference for housing that would maintain public access to the waterfront is reflected in the plan for the Outer Harbor. Buffalo police are investigating attempted abductions of city children. WBFO's Eileen Buckley says police have beefed up patrols outside Buffalo public schools, and now the school district is ramping up awareness with students and parents.
Buffalo police are trying to track down a couple that's been driving in a white or tan color Lexus sedan. They've been involved in four reported attempted abductions of teenagers outside of city schools.
You haven't given out the license plate number on the Lexus. Why not?
Because we don't have the actual license plate of the Lexus. There are different scenarios that are coming up. We're not ready to release a license plate till we're sure it is the vehicle in question.
Police Commissioner Daniel Durenda updating reporters after a fifth incident on Monday. Two 13-year-old boys reported a black couple in a silver minivan approached them near the McDonald's at Genesee and Bailey, trying to lure them into their vehicle. But one of those suspects informed police it was all a mistake. And after questioning the individual and meeting with the Erie County District Attorney, police say no charges would be filed. The other attempts, however, are still under investigation. The city school district is taking them very seriously.
If students are approached by an adult that they don't know, by a person that they don't know, they need to run, yell, and tell.
Associate Superintendent for Student Support Will Carestis warns parents to know where their children are at all times.
If parents are working and they're unable to provide that direct supervision, then they need to have a designee step up and assume that responsibility at their request, again, to know where their young people are at all times.
Last night, the school district issued a robocall to all parents. A letter went out to school families last week. Another letter is expected to be mailed today. Extra police patrols have been established in and around the city schools. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
Late yesterday afternoon, a man was gunned down on Herb Street on the city's east side. As WBFO's Mike Desmond reports, little more than an hour later, a panel discussion took place at Olmsted School. The topic? Crime on the east side.
The man wasn't identified during the meeting sponsored by U.S. Attorney William Hochul. It's the first of the Take Back Our Streets meetings seeking public health in solving crimes. Law enforcement officials say they need more cooperation from witnesses to crime, even if just a phone call. They say it's a real problem when someone who might help solve a crime won't come forward, but might complain to police when the victim is close to them, but they wouldn't help in another crime. Reverend Darren Young from St. John Baptist Church admits it's a problem, but police have to help.
There was a woman recently right here in Langfield who had reported on some young men. They beat the woman senseless to a pulp, and police response wasn't great at all to assist this woman and to get her the help that she necessarily needed.
Young says police sometimes show up at the potential witness home for information, making it clear who talked. Almost all speakers say crime has a bad effect on their homes, their children, their communities. Hochul says law enforcement has crushed a series of powerful local street gangs and put most members in jail. Mike Desmond, WBFO News.
Amherst Middle School students are kicking off a year-long service project this morning. It's aimed at helping the Family Resource Center at Women and Children's Hospital. School principal Michael Cornell says it's a way to teach kids a lesson they can take with them forever.
So we have, you know, depending on the year, between 28 and 30% free and reduced lunch. You know, kids who come from an impoverished background who typically don't feel very empowered. And what we want to do is help them to feel empowered and help them to know that, you know, that every child in our school, all 700 of them, have the ability, have the power to make a difference in the lives of someone else. And that's, you know, really how the world becomes a better place.
Students and staff will be taking part in at least a half a dozen activities this year, from a donation drive to a talent show to raise money and other goods for the center. Rain during the day today, the high 65, right now 58 degrees at 810. Good morning, this is WBFO.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. The United States strategy against the group called ISIS has an upside and a downside. The upside is that the United States has assembled a coalition. The downside is that the United States has assembled a coalition. This week, President Obama met military leaders from 21 countries that have joined the U.S. Iraqis and Syrians are fighting for themselves on the ground, with other Arab nations joining the air campaign. And that's all good from a U.S. perspective. The trouble, as we'll report this morning, is that not all of those countries share exactly the same interests, so not all are on the same page. Our coverage starts with NPR's Scott Horsley.
It's been just over a month since President Obama went before the American people and spelled out his strategy for degrading and defeating the militants. Obama says the U.S. and its allies have enjoyed some successes, driving ISIS away from the Mosul Dam, for example. But the president says he remains deeply concerned about the besieged Syrian town of Kobani, as well as parts of Iraq's Anbar province, where ISIS has been tightening its grip.
As with any military effort, there will be days of progress, and there are going to be periods of setback.
Critics, like Republican Senator John McCain, are challenging the president's strategy as ISIS captures more territory in both Syria and Iraq.
They're winning, and we're not. The Iraqis are not winning. The Peshmerga, the Kurds are not winning. And there has to be a fundamental reevaluation of what we're doing.
Speaking on CNN, McCain dismissed the U.S.-led airstrikes as mere pinpricks that haven't stopped the militants. Military analyst Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies agrees. So far, the air war has fallen short of what was done in Kosovo or Kuwait.
In general, this has been a very limited, very slow campaign, flying something like an average of 15 strikes a day, a lot of it against individual weapon systems. By the standards of past U.S. air campaigns, that's a very small effort.
Even as the pace of airstrikes picked up this week around Kobani, Obama stressed the campaign to defeat ISIS can't be waged on strictly military terms.
This is not a classic army in which we defeat them on the battlefield and then they ultimately surrender. What we're also fighting is an ideological strain of extremism that has taken root in too many parts of the region.
Obama says the U.S. and its allies have to offer political and economic alternatives to the militants. In the meantime, the U.S.-led military effort is being hampered by some of the same sectarian and political divisions that helped give rise to ISIS. The U.S. and Turkey, for example, have yet to agree on which enemy in Syria is a bigger threat, ISIS or the regime of Bashar al-Assad. And in Iraq, Sunni Muslims have yet to join forces with Shiites in battling the militants, despite the formation of a more inclusive Iraqi government. The U.S. strategy depends on cooperation from local ground forces to beat back ISIS. Until that cooperation materializes, Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution warns, airstrikes can only do so much.
ISIS will probably expand its control by a few percent, 5%, 10% of either country. It's unlikely to be able to make huge new inroads. Unfortunately, the sides that we're fighting with, the people we're hoping to see defeat ISIS, are not yet in a position to do so.
Obama has been adamant that he won't order American ground forces into battle. But O'Hanlon says a limited presence of U.S. special forces and military spotters could be helpful.
I would hate to see the president decide that this is just politically undoable, even though it's going to be, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 U.S. troops, far, far, far fewer than we had during the height of the war.
Obama, who was dragged reluctantly back into a Middle East conflict, says the U.S. is still in the early stages of what he promises will be a long-term campaign. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
8:14. Good morning. This is Morning Edition on 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo. Later this hour, Chris Kea will report on a new visitors experience coming to Niagara Falls. That on the way just after 8:30. A lot of traffic issues to talk about this morning. A little bit of rain most certainly making a difference in the morning commute. An accident now reported to us on the just at the base of the inbound skyway on Route 5 this morning. That obviously is causing significant delays. Same along the 290 eastbound with an accident near Niagara Falls Boulevard blocking the left lane. The thruway eastbound has been slow pretty much on and off all the way from West Seneca through Cheektowaga this morning. The time, 8:15. This is WBFO.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from Schmitz Audi. Schmitz Audi is proud to introduce the all-new 2015 Audi A3 premium sedan. Schmitz currently has a selection of Audi A3s in stock and in their showroom, and test drives for the A3 are available. More information about the Audi A3 at schmitzaudi.com. Schmitz Audi is located at 5255 Genesee Street, just east of Transit Road.
Well, rainy commutes could be pretty much the norm over the next few days here, with rain expected throughout the day today. The high 65 tonight, a chance of rain, low 55 tomorrow. Partly sunny early, but rain perhaps for the afternoon. Thursday's high 65. Friday, cloudy with the chance of rain, the high 58. And cool on the weekend with temperatures only in the 40s. Right now, it's 58 degrees.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from Trinity Church. If you've ever wondered what those collectibles you have stashed in your attic are worth, fine art and antique appraisers will be on hand Saturday, October 25th, as Trinity Church in downtown Buffalo presents Out of the Attic. Your admission ticket includes a verbal appraisal on three items: tours, guest lecturers, and a soup cafe. Join the fun on October 25th from 10 to 3 p.m. Ticket information online at trinitybuffalo.org.
Well, so far, so good this morning with a WBFO membership campaign. And let's check in with another update with Eileen Buckley and Jim Berryman.
All right. Thank you very much, Jay. And we are back again, Eileen and I, to talk to you about membership. Before we say that, you know, I was listening to Jay, Eileen, talk about the weather and the commute. And it's funny because, you know, everybody says, well, Buffalo, you can get anywhere in 20 minutes, except when it rains. And you aren't going anywhere. I just wanted to point that out. I've been in it. I can't get to work when it rains. All right, anyway, our toll-free number is 1-877-511-1017. Online, you can find us at WBFO.org. Find us on your smartphone. Get that app if you don't have it. Put it on your smartphone. You can pledge there if you want. We're in the middle of our fall membership drive. And now the last 2 hours, Eileen, have been successful. Thank you so much to everyone who, you know, were up with the birds like we were and called and made their pledge of support. Well, now, as I predicted, it didn't take a genius to figure this out, but it's now in the 8 o'clock hour, and we have a bigger goal this hour. A bigger goal, Eileen.
Absolutely. So we have $2,000 to raise now in less than an hour. So we need 20 people to step up this hour to make their pledge of support to Morning Edition in this busy 8 o'clock hour. Jim mentioned the weather, the traffic, of course. You know, then you have more time in your car, of course, if you're slowed down in traffic to listen to us, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's also a place where you will be informed about those conditions. And we all know we're heading into the fall winter season, which could be a brutal one again, if, like we had last year with
the
snow.
Let's hope not.
So you know that you can depend on information from our station, because our department, our newsroom, is always percolating with a lot of news and information. And we're always on the phones and working hard in those situations, too. Dependability is really what it's all about, and we're listener supported. That means you, the listener, help support this radio station, help support 88.7 FM on the dial. Right now, 20 calls to go, 1-877-511-1017, 1-877-511-1017. Make your contribution, support to public radio, and keep this great Morning Edition program on the air where you rely on it every day.
That's right. And you know, you've heard us from time to time, I'm sure, mention the 7% impact. And I want to just kind of update you on that. The situation is that when we look at the member to listener ratio of the stations here, that would be WNED-FM, television, and WBFO, we find that the member to listener ratio ship is 4%. Now, nationwide, the average is 7%, thus the name 7% impact. That's what we're trying to do, is we want to bring that number up to 7%. And one of the points that I've been making, and if you take a look at everything that you hear on this station and the top-notch reporting from both our local news staff to NPR to PRI to APM shows, the BBC overnight, think about what we can do if we had that number up to 7%. And that's basically how I think we need to view it. Look at how good we're doing now, but we can do better, you know. What does that mean to you? Well, it means that you need to get involved. That's what it means. It means you need to become a part of the membership process here at the radio station. Join our family. It's easy to do. It's quick. It's painless. On and off the phone in 2 minutes. If you want to do it online, guess what? It takes 2 minutes. You know, same difference. If you want to take more time and look at the thank yous, they're online, WBFO.org. Pledge there. If you want to talk to a volunteer, if you have any questions about payments, payment arrangements, or any of those things, they'll certainly spend time. They'll talk to you about the thank yous if you need. But, you know, if you know what your pledge level is and you know all your other vitals, which I'm assuming you do, you'll be on and off the phone in 2 minutes. 1-877-511-1017. 19 calls to go now, Eileen.
19 calls. People are actually stepping up and doing their part to become members of WBFO or perhaps renewing their membership to WBFO. You can call us right now at 1-877-511-1017. And, you know, we talk about those pledge levels. Last hour, we did have someone step up and give us $1,000.
They did. I know. Thank you.
What a wonderful donation to this public radio station. What a wonderful commitment to WBFO and what a wonderful member. That's what it's all about. Again, $60 membership, basic level, that's fine. We'll take it. We'll be pleased to take your pledge of support.
Pleased as punch, as we say.
It's certainly helpful here, and you can select from the great array of thank you gifts. But again, those are the type of pledges that we receive here on WBFO. As Jim said, we're down to 19 calls this hour, and we're asking now for you to step up and consider support, listener support at WBFO, 1-877-511-1017 to talk to our volunteers right now. Or perhaps if you're at your computer at work already or at home, you can go online to WBFO.org. And thanks.
Thank you.
Here's the problem with the United States putting pressure on Russia. The U.S. would like Russia to pay a penalty for its interference in neighboring Ukraine, but the U.S. also needs Russian help on other issues, like limiting the nuclear program of Iran. The deadline to reach a nuclear deal with Iran is near. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna today, meeting with his Iranian counterpart. He has also been consulting in Europe with vital partners in that effort against Iran, including Russia. And the U.S. attitude toward Russia seems to be changing. NPR's Michelle Kellerman is traveling with the secretary.
The scene has become a familiar one. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov arrives at the U.S. Ambassador's mansion in Paris for another lengthy meeting with Secretary Kerry. They ditch their aides and walk in the garden to sit on a bench and chat for a bit. Afterwards, it's clear they haven't gotten anywhere on Ukraine. Kerry came out with a list of demands.
The shooting around Donetsk Airport and other parts of eastern Ukraine has to stop. Foreign forces and weapons need to be withdrawn. All hostages need to be released.
And Kerry says sovereignty must be restored along the Ukrainian-Russian border. For now, Ukraine is unable to control it. Lavrov was having none of that at his news conference at the Russian ambassador's residence. He simply brushed aside a question about what, if any, assurances he gave Kerry about Ukraine.
Знаете, мы с господином Керри не представляем воюющие стороны.
You know, Mr. Kerry and I don't represent the warring parties here, Lavrov says, stressing that the conflict can only be resolved through negotiations among those involved in the hostilities. And by that, he means only Ukraine and the separatists in the east. Russia has always downplayed its role, though it does have troops on the ground. On Ukraine, it seems, the two men have agreed to disagree.
And so we talked about many other issues besides Ukraine. In fact, the bulk of the conversation today was on a host of other issues.
Kerry and Lavrov seem to suggest a new reset in relations, though they aren't using that word. They both talked about the need to cooperate where they can, on containing the outbreak of Ebola in West Africa and countering the self-proclaimed Islamic State militant group, or ISIL, as Kerry calls it.
I suggested to Foreign Minister Lavrov that we intensify intelligence cooperation with respect to ISIL and other counterterrorism challenges of the region, and we agreed to do so.
Lavrov confirmed that and spoke about other areas of cooperation. Russia and the U.S. play a special role, he says, in settling issues on the global agenda. One pressing issue now is Iran's nuclear program and negotiations over how to curb it. Secretary Kerry says he wasn't ready to make any predictions about the talks. Lavrov seemed upbeat, saying he felt that Russia's partners in this, including the two men he met here in Paris, the French foreign minister and Secretary Kerry, are taking the right approach. I'm confident that compromise is possible, Lavrov says, though he adds he can't guarantee that a deal will be reached by November 24th. He says the main thing is to reach a good deal. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Paris.
Chocolate makers said today they are contributing several $100,000 to fight Ebola in West Africa. The companies include Nestle and Hershey's. They say they want to protect the world's largest suppliers of cocoa, Ghana and Ivory Coast. Now, to be clear, Ebola has not crossed over to those cocoa-producing countries, and yet Ebola has already affected the price of a chocolate bar even here in the United States. NPR's Gregory Warner has been asking why.
A few weeks ago, Jack Scoville was buying himself a chocolate bar, Hershey's milk, at a corner store in Chicago, and he noticed that the price was just a little bit higher, about 5 or 10 cents. His first thought was not to blame a greedy store owner or even the executives in Hershey, Pennsylvania. Scoville was blaming the West African Ebola virus.
Sure, it's occurred to me. I don't know that the average guy in the street would.
But Scoville is not your average chocolate eater. He's a senior market analyst at Price Futures Group looking at the cocoa commodities market. And last month, cocoa contracts, that is the price that, for instance, chocolate makers agree to pay for raw cocoa, spiked in large part on Ebola fears.
The price made the move to three-year highs in response to the Ebola crisis and fears that it could spread into Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Ivory Coast and Ghana together produce more than half the world's cocoa, and they're just next door to Ebola-affected countries Liberia and Guinea. Now, everyone I've interviewed for this story wants me to remind you that you cannot get Ebola from chocolate. The fear, rather, was that if Ebola jumped over the border to Ivory Coast, those cocoa farmers would scatter. The cocoa fruits, it's the seeds of the fruit that we call the cocoa bean, would stay unpicked, and Halloween would become as expensive as Christmas.
That would be the fear.
Or that was the fear until the end of September, when this fear, as with so many that seemed to petrify the markets, suddenly vanished. The price eased back, maybe because enough weeks had passed and Ebola hadn't jumped the border, or because Ivory Coast reassuringly locked down its land borders, allowing almost no human traffic from Ebola-affected countries.
The market feels like we've dodged a bullet.
But if you leave aside the markets and consider what is now happening on those cocoa farms as a result of those sealed borders, most of the workers that harvest cocoa in Ivory Coast are migrant workers from Liberia and Guinea who now can't cross the border to pick that cocoa.
Well, we are at the critical phase of the season at the moment because the season starts at the beginning of October.
George Edward is head of group research for Ecobank, it's a Pan-African bank.
And if Côte d'Ivoire's agriculture sector loses all of its laborers, that will have a huge impact in terms of the crop and what can actually be harvested.
Ecobank researchers predict that farms will procure pod pickers from elsewhere, but they cannot be sure how the season will go. And the reason that they're not sure is also a second-order impact of Ebola. See, usually at this time you'd have swarms of agronomists sent by chocolate companies into West Africa to literally count trees and pods on the trees, and use mathematical modeling to predict, to great accuracy, the world's supply of cocoa this year. But because of Ebola, many of those pod counters never boarded the plane, even to Ebola-free Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Without having the agronomists there now, a lot of the trips have been cancelled. They just don't want to send the Europeans to the region, even in areas that are not infected with Ebola. That means this information is not coming in. So this entire cocoa season, we could be walking in the dark.
So let me ask my most important question. Should I stock up on, 200 chocolate bars just in case?
Yes, actually. Well, it doesn't necessarily keep that well. So I don't know, unless you're going to eat 200 chocolate bars in a couple of months.
To put this in perspective, though, if cocoa prices do spike, it means people will eat less chocolate. When migrant workers aren't able to reach the fields and send those wages home because the borders are locked down, that means some families won't eat at all. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CFP, on behalf of certified financial planner professionals committed to the highest standard in personal financial advice at letsmakeaplan.org. From Regis, providing office solutions for startups to Fortune 500s with 700 U.S. locations. More at 1-800-OFFICES. And from Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Outback. Love. It's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. This is NPR.
And good morning to you. The time, 8:29. This is your NPR station in Western New York, 88.7 FM, WBFO. We're experiencing a rainy day today here in Western New York. The high temperature expected to reach 65. Right now it is 58 degrees in Buffalo, 54 in Jamestown, and 59 in Olean. A couple of traffic notes for you this morning. Looks like that accident cleared on the 290 eastbound near Niagara Falls Boulevard, but still some congestion in place. And also a report of an accident earlier this hour along inbound Route 5 at the base of the Skyway. That also may be cleared at this time as well. The time is 8:30. Erie County Executive Mark Poloncar's 2015 budget plan holds the line on property taxes. That's according to the Buffalo News this morning, which reports the $1.43 billion plan is nearly a 3% hike over the current year's plan. Increased spending will reportedly be covered by growth in the county property tax levy and a project increase in sales tax revenue. The Poloncar's budget will be released officially at 10 o'clock this morning. A Lewiston man remains in the Niagara County Jail this morning on charges that he kidnapped and tortured several victims in his home. Ivor Fallon pleaded not guilty to a 122-count indictment on Tuesday. In sports, the Buffalo Sabres won their first game yesterday, last night rather. Marcus Foligno with two goals, Zemgus Girgensson scoring the shootout winner as the Sabres beat Carolina by a 4-3 score. Major League Baseball in the championship series play, Kansas City over Baltimore 2-1. San Francisco beat St. Louis 5-4. In 10 innings. The time, 8:31. Good morning. This is WBFO. Crews have been working recently on a new destination for visitors to explore in Niagara Falls. As WBFO's Chris Kaya reports, it's part of the state's effort to keep the historic Mist of the Maid afloat.
Major improvements to the Niagara Gorge Discovery Center and surrounding area are almost complete. Located just off the Robert Moses Parkway, the center sits on the rim of the gorge next to a helicopter tour company. The site is where the Sholkoff Power Station stood until it collapsed into the gorge in 1956. Under a long-term agreement with Albany in 2012, State Parks District Director Mark Thomas says land along the lower Niagara, once part of a power plant, has been transformed into a boat dock and winter storage facility for the Maid of the Mist.
They shouldered that cost. It was not a state investment.
The company's $32 million investment includes a massive boat crane and yards of concrete, which saved Maid of the Mist from going under after losing its contract and docking rights in Canada to a competitor. Thomas says once completed, a new observation deck above and the facility at the bottom of the gorge will be turned over to state parks.
We'll be able to take people for the first time down there, down by the elevator to the area and show them what it was like so they get a sense of the scale.
The former Sholkoff was one of the first hydroelectric plants in the world.
They had a lot to do with our industrial growth here in Western New York and for the Northeast. There's a lot of generation of power came right out of here, out of Niagara. This place changed the world.
Thomas points out the complex was actually made up of three separate power plants.
So that's the nice thing down there. You can say this is where the tail race was. These are where the penstocks were. This is where it blew off. This is the remnants of it. There's an even top up one of the generators still sitting down there in the, buried in the rubble down there that you can see. And get actually see the size of that piece alone. It helps you get a sense, again, of the scale, the magnitude of this thing.
Visitors will also be able to see the geology that helped shape the landscape.
When you see that and you experience it down below, it opens up a whole new experience here in the park that we've never been able to offer. So this is an exciting new educational opportunity. It's a recreational opportunity because the fishermen will be using it down there, already are.
It also provides a new access point along the lower Niagara, which Thomas says in the past was only open to the most experienced hikers.
One trail goes down and ties into the old rail gorge rail trail and comes right back up here to the Discovery Center. Or it goes all the way down to Whirlpool Bridge, where you can take the stairway that NIPA built a couple years ago right back up by the Whirlpool Bridges.
And Thomas says State Parks gorge crews will be opening up other trails.
There's some beautiful country back up in there. You don't think it's all that big, but once you get down in there, it's huge. Yeah, it's a lot of real estate down there that people haven't been able to use and can now.
The lower level of the Niagara Gorge Discovery Center is expected to open in time for next tourist season. Chris Kaya, WBFO News.